on radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is Invest Talk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. Here is KPP Financial Portfolio Manager, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to InvestTalk. My name is Luke Guerrero, and today is Thursday, May 16th, 2024, which means not only are we halfway through May, we are officially halfway through the second quarter of 2024. What a second quarter it has been. Earnings have come in a little bit higher than some people have expected. Inflation seems to be perhaps back in a downward trend, and the labor market and the economy as a whole seems to be slowing. Now, other than that, and other than info on what has happened in the market today and some stories that I found particularly interesting that I'm going to bring to you a little bit later, we're going to hopefully talk to some of you live and certainly answer your voicemail questions, your iTunes review questions, and your YouTube questions. With that being said, before we talk about market performance for the day and run down those show topics that I briefly mentioned we will touch on, we want to tackle our first caller question now.
Hey guys, this is John from Atlanta calling. I just wanted to see if you could take a look at Sprouts for me, SFR. Me and my wife and have a competition every year where we see who can do the better investing, and she's beat me this year with that stock. So trying to see if it is worth getting into or if it's just too overpriced for me at the moment. If you could just evaluate it. Thank you.
Well, John, congratulations to your wife who is up year to date, though I will say there's a lot of time left in this year for you to catch up. But let's take a look at Sprouts. Sprouts Farmers Market, ticker SFM, is a organic, natural, and fresh grocery store that has certainly been on a tear. Not only is it up 60% year to date, it is also up 113% on a 52-week basis. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that their revenue growth has been pretty significant over the past couple years, especially for a grocery store, up 6% on annual year over year over the past 5 years. And they have done so with modest amounts of debt. It's a $7 billion company, almost $8 billion company. They only have about $1.6 billion in debt. And even with that, their interest coverage ratio is about 60 times. So their margins are fine. They have anywhere they could go. They could take on more debt. They're not squeezed at all. So their net margins have been pretty stable over the past 5 years, around 3%, 2%, 4%. And it's supposed to be about 4.3% next year. Now, one of the things that has really helped out this company is that there was a lot of short interest going into December. There was about 20%. That's down to about 13% now. So what you're seeing in the chart technically was a lot of that it was a result of a short squeeze. And so with the short interest dropping down from 20 to 13%, you see a lot of that short interest is closed. A lot of those shorts have closed. They were kind of blown out by some of the upward activity. Now, over the past 3 years, their cash flow has been improving pretty significantly. Their profitability has been relatively stable, and their relative strength has really only improved. And even with the run-up over the past year, their price to book sits at about 6.4, which is certainly well above their 5-year average of 3.7. But still nothing too crazy. Their PE is at 24 times, which for a grocer is a little too expensive for my blood. But, you know, with this name, we're about 2 weeks away from it announcing earnings. It looks like its consensus is a 7.77 per share. It's kind of a narrow range between 0.75 and 0.79. So it'll be interesting to see, given how they performed over the last quarter, what that does to their forward-looking guidance and what that does to their relative valuation as well. Honestly, it's a good company. I think there's a pretty good trend towards people being more health conscious, and Sprouts is certainly a good market for those reasons, and their revenue has grown because of that. I like that they have bought back shares over the past 5 years, and I like the trend in their earnings as well. But at a PDE, forward-looking PDE of 24, and with earnings coming up in the next 2 weeks, I certainly would hold off just to see how some things shake out. That's a little too expensive. It's had a run up. I think it probably has more room to run, but I would wait and see. Keep it on your watch list. Wouldn't buy in right now. Thanks for the call. Now, we got a lot of ground to cover over the next 45 minutes or so. So here is some of what I have planned for you, time permitting. My main focus point concerns this question: beyond efficiency, are the markets sensible? Sometimes financial markets do cross the sensibility line, but it's difficult to profit from that knowledge. So in order to understand that, we'll talk a little bit about treasury bonds, we'll talk about financial markets, and if you don't know what it is, I'll explain to you what the efficient markets hypothesis is. We'll also talk a little bit about a soft landing, a phrase that I hadn't even heard before the last couple years, but something that's certainly been said a lot, and that in spite of a little hitch in deflationary traction and a hotter than expected economy, America still seems to be headed for a soft landing. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about what that means for your portfolio. We will also talk a little bit about Walmart and what Walmart's earnings tell us about the retail space as well, should we have time at the end of the show. And I also want to touch on a Supreme Court ruling on the Financial Protection Bureau, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that goes to the heart of how it's funded, how a lot of agencies are funded, and how they, some of them, tend to remain and are able to remain independent despite shifting political headwinds. We also have some voice bank questions ready to play, including one on Vital Farms, VITL, which you may recall from our Market Madness competition, and Aon, which might have been in there as well. I also have some questions that came in from comment section of our InvestTalk YouTube channel, as well as some iTunes review questions. And of course, I welcome your finance and investment questions now or anytime over the next hour on 888-99-CHART. Now we're going into a short break, and on the other side, we'll talk about the day's market activity. Please remember that you can call anytime and leave your question on the InvestTalk voice bank, or better yet, call now, 888-99-CHART.
InvestTalk callers make each podcast unique.
I was calling about Intel, if it's worth holding on to, or should I sell it?
Their questions are curious.
I have saved up around $80,000, and I was wondering what I should do to make it grow.
Careful.
Oh, I'm just wondering, is this a value trap? Because it looks like it's gone down quite a bit.
Concerned.
It's taken quite the tumble today. I've been trying to get out of this position for a while. I think I waited too long.
And clever.
Looking at Dominion Energy, Inc. It does seem to be situated in some areas of expanding population.
And Justin Klein and now Luke Guerrero are always ready with their unbiased answers.
And this is, it looks like a classic example of chasing yield. Don't chase the yield.
Next 12 months price to earnings is around 30. I just don't see it at this price.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk 888-99-CHART. Got finance and investment questions, and Luke Guerrero is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk 888-99-CHART.
Let's talk a little bit about the market today. U.S. equities ended lower in trading near session lows after being up for most of the day, and that comes after yesterday's rally that saw the S&P 500 and NASDAQ hit fresh record highs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average broke 40,000 intraday today, but even after all that, the Dow finished down 10 basis points, the S&P 500 was down 21 basis points, and the Russell 2000 small caps were down 63 basis points. Today's underperformers included home builders, pharma, semis, entertainment, airlines, some of that discretionary spending. Outperformers were more of those staple retailers, PNC insurance, managed care grocers, food, those necessities. Big tech, kind of mixed today. The two-year yield was back above 4.75%. Gold ended down 40 basis points. And West Texas Intermediate crude settled up about 80 basis points. Overall, stocks had a largely uneventful trading session and lost some of that early steam and strength that carried over from Wednesday. But the strong landing narrative, the soft landing narrative, which we'll talk a little about later, maintained its traction. It's really the big tailwind for some of the risk-on sentiment as of late. Growth still running above trend in 2024 consensus for low double-digit earnings growth, kind of holding steady. Another busy day on the economic calendar as well. Initial claims touch above forecast. Continuing claims came in relatively high as well. Housing starts and building permits both missed, though March starts saw big downward revisions. Also a busy day for Fed speak, where the general consensus was really that trends are improving, which is something I agree with, but still there's not enough confidence to even begin thinking about cutting. Looking ahead to next week, or really tomorrow, actually, we get the Leading Indicators Index, and next week we get FOMC minutes midweek. So it'll be interesting to see what both of those figures tell us and how the market spends the next week digesting that information. Now, you probably noticed that we are answering questions submitted by viewers to our YouTube channel. That's because we post the podcast in video form each weeknight. And here's one that came in today. Jim Leahy 8312 said, do you think MSCI is a good buy and hold based on its current price? So MSCI, for those of you who don't know, is, while I pull it up here for our viewers at home, MSCI is a benchmark company. It's a financial company. It's a data processing company. And their biggest revenue segment doesn't come from their analytics. It comes from their index constituency and index provider processes. And so what that means is they provide benchmark indices for various markets, global, international markets, bond markets, but they also provide benchmarking for big funds, and those funds are paying for those benchmarks. And so looking at MSCI, I think the biggest thing that benefits this company, which is a pretty big company, its market cap is $39 billion, it's more in the mid-cap, larger size of the mid-cap space, is inertia, right? So they are getting annual fees from these funds. Funds don't change prospectus benchmarks very often. It's a very well-known index provider. And because of that, when they come up with more and more indices, they tend to be the preferred index of most, especially international funds. In the US, you'll see the Russell used a lot as a benchmark index, but internationally, you see almost exclusively the MSCI used. So that's one benefit that they have. And they've been really had some great growth, especially for a company that has a pretty simplistic business model. 12% year over year for the past 5 years on an annualized basis. And year to date, they're down 12%. And looking at their cash flow and their profitability, let me pull that up here. Before we talk about their cash flow and profitability as that pulls up, let's take a look at their debt levels. They only got $4 billion on debt, which given their size, that's completely fine. Their margins are great. This is a level of margins that you only see within the finance industry. Upwards of 30% on their net margins. They're supposed to have a net margin of 39%, down from 45% last year. Looking at their cash flow is fantastic. Their cash flow is really, it looks like a straight line upwards, for those of you who can't see it. If you want to take a look, it's something to behold. So, you know, overall, I think MSCI is a great company. They have pretty inflated valuation right now, unfortunately, 31 times. So I wouldn't buy it just now. I think there's been quite the run-up. I always tell people, if you're looking to get some of that financial exposure, some of the best ways to do it actually isn't those banks, but really what I like to call the plumbing of the financial system, index providers, exchanges. So MSCI is a great company. They got a great business. They have a great moat. That's why they're trading at the multiple that they are. It's actually down from their five-year average, but still a little bit too expensive for me. Maybe wait for it to come down to the 450 level before you look to buy it. Thanks for watching and thanks for the comment. Now let's grab another caller question. This came in from a listener who lives in Arizona.
Hey guys, Art from Tucson here, calling in today about Dutch Bros Inc., D-R-O-S, the drive-through coffee house, probably familiar with it, seem to be popping up all over the place. I have a very small position in it, just mainly to track it. It's gone up significantly. I think I'm up about 40% on it now. It had a great earnings last time. It consistently, it looks like it's had pretty good earnings. Seems very expensive, but it also seems like it's growing very quickly. Wondering what you think about it here, if you think it's a good company to invest in, and what a good buying point would be, if I should wait for it to pull back to buy some more, or if now is a good time to pick up some more. Anyway, I listen on the podcast and appreciate you guys a lot. Thanks for all you do for us.
The question is about Dutch Bros, which anecdotally for you, this is a really interesting coffee chain. I think where I live in Southern California, there's not many of them. But when I was driving to San Francisco one time, I drove past one, and I cannot tell you, I have never seen a drive-through line as long as Dutch Bros coffee. So it must be good coffee. But anyway, so it is a fast coffee chain. That certainly has been growing. They haven't been operating for 5 years. So if you see this, or they haven't been public for 5 years. So if you see this revenue growth right here, they went public in 2021. That's why you don't see a number here. But regardless, you can tell here that their revenue growth is fantastic, up from in 2019, $238 million, now at $1.22 billion. Their cash flow is improving. Their profitability is improving. They don't have a lot of debt, but they also have been issuing a lot of shares as their newly public company. That's not unique. But your question was about relative valuation. Price to earnings of 95, price to book of 8.4. Absolutely not. That is incredibly expensive. They make coffee. They are not revolutionizing the world. Keep it on your watch list. Do not buy it now. I think they have a lot of room to grow. They've been growing pretty consistently. But again, it's not about just buying good businesses. It's about buying good businesses at fair prices. I think this one's a little overpriced at the moment. Now we're moving into a quick break. If you feel like talking, I'm here. Give me a call, 888-99-CHART.
No two portfolios are alike, and every investor has a unique set of circumstances. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
My main focus point today concerns this question. Beyond efficiency, are markets sensible? Sometimes financial markets do cross the sensibility line, but is it difficult to profit from that knowledge? And more importantly, is it difficult to profit from that knowledge consistently? So let's dig into financial markets and the efficient market hypothesis and what all this means. And it's important to start with the fact that there are some nuances between the ideas of what we mean when we say market sensibility and what we mean when we say market efficiency. And even academic institutions grapple with this inconsistency, as highlighted in some discourse that comes out of the University of Chicago, where there is the Nobel Prize-winning behavioral economist and the Nobel Prize-winning economist who came up with the efficient markets hypothesis. And so events such as the meme mania naturally lead us to question not just the EMH, efficient markets hypothesis, but the broader rationality of investment markets as a whole. So before we start, let's talk about what the efficient markets hypothesis, or what I will say is the EMH from now on, and what it means. And so there are levels to it, but the basics are that stock prices, asset prices, reflect some level of information, be it public or all non-public info. So weak form efficiency implies that technical analysis can consistently beat markets. Semi-strong efficiency means that all public information is incorporated in asset prices. And strong efficiency means that all non-public information is incorporated in asset prices, meaning you should not at all be able to beat markets because all assets are fairly valued. And so this is some pretty foundational financial stuff. Like I mentioned, it was spearheaded by a legendary Chicago professor, Eugene Fama, who, in the interest of full disclosure, was a looming figure and board member of my old firm. And depending on the level of efficiency, this hypothesis says that beating the market consistently through either technical or insider information should be impossible. Yet, anomalies and crises, like Black Monday in 1987, where markets just decided to plunge 20% for no reason, challenge this view. So if that's efficiency, what is sensibility? Well, this is the idea that market decisions should be based on sound judgment, practical ideas, and a good understanding of the investment landscape and the reasons why you're doing something. And this doesn't mean that every market decision needs to be correct, doesn't need to always be right, but it should be justifiable and based on available information at the time. Let's take, for example, the case of Apple in 1997. The company's stock was trading at a split-adjusted 10 cents. Boy, don't we wish we could all get in back then, because the market widely expected it to file for bankruptcy. Fast forward a couple months and the return of Steve Jobs and significant investment from Microsoft unexpectedly revitalized the company. And so, you know, leading to a dramatic stock price increase. And so this turnaround, while not predictable, sensibly justified risk given the information available at the time, that would be a sensible investment. On the contrary, think about GameStop today. Is it sensible that retail money threw themselves in to a stock that was not doing well, AMC, that doesn't make money, because of a tweet? That's not a sensible thing to do. And so although I generally believe that in the long run, markets are both sensible and at least semi-strong efficient, meaning they incorporate public information, and that technical analysis alone cannot consistently beat markets, it doesn't mean they're always right. It doesn't mean for every asset it's always perfect. Of course, that's not the case. And the reasons why is because both of these things are based upon models. And models are nothing more than simplifications of reality. They're academic exercises that try and explain things in a frictionless environment. But if you go into the trading world, the real world, reality comes in. It has frictions. It has costs. It has human psychology. Not everybody operates based upon the same utility maximization as everybody else. And so as more events like meme mania pop up, the argument about market efficiency and sensibility will likely rage on. We will revisit this year after year, month after month, and the same arguments will be made. But regardless, I think we can take an important lesson away here. And that is, even in the short term, prices diverge from reality, as they did with GameStop. They never stay on the moon. They always say we're headed to the moon. They never stay on the moon. They always head back down to Earth eventually, head back down to rationality, and head back down to what their fundamental value implies they should be. Now let's pivot back to the InvestTalk voice bank. You know the number, 888-99-CHART.
Hey guys, it's Shane from Florida. Love what you guys do. Long listener of the show. My question is about IRAs. Just recently created one. Was wondering how I should allocate my funds. Should I use mutual funds as the base of my portfolio? Thanks, guys, for all you do. Appreciate the work. I'll be listening in for the answer. Thank you.
So this is an important question. How should you allocate your funds? And because I don't know much about you, though you are a listener and we appreciate that, it's difficult to say what your exact allocation should be. So let me give you some general advice. If you are younger, in your 20s and 30s, you have a long time to grow your capital, which means you should be more heavily allocated towards equities and less so allocated towards that capital-preserving fixed income. Now, as you get older, you'll want to shift that mix because you'll be coming closer and closer to retirement where you'll be needing to use that money. Now, for most investors, mutual funds are really ETFs, which have become more popular in recent years because they give you not a net asset value at the end of the day, but live pricing based upon the assets. They're a pretty good representation of what the ETF has. Is a great way to start to build your portfolio. Some investors want to take it a step further and do individual research. And so what I would say is, given that you're clearly new to this, start with ETFs, get some bonds in there, create an allocation that's appropriate for your age, and then maybe start to do a little more. Tilt towards something that you believe, based upon your investment philosophy, based upon your experience, may be able to outperform. But still, it's never a bad idea to have the base of your portfolio be those funds that are broadly diversified. Thanks for the call. We're headed to a short break, so give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It is official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. At this point, I think almost everyone has heard how generative AI promises to bring us to the next industrial revolution. AI is already shaping society with an impact on daily life that echoes the transformative significance of electricity or the internet. As we take steps to embrace the potential of generative AI, we need to remain vigilant with regard to its exploitability. This is where HackerOne comes in. HackerOne's AI Red Team addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses that are launching new AI deployments. The HackerOne approach involves targeted offensive testing by harnessing the collective skills of ethical hackers who are proficient in AI and prompt hacking. In short, AI red teaming is the practice of stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. HackerOne seamlessly integrates with your existing tools to enhance communication and collaboration across development, security, and IT teams. So, stay ahead of the game in the battle against cyber threats with HackerOne's Attack Resistance platform. Learn more at HackerOne.com. That's HackerOne.com, HackerOne.com.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Now, we put together a fresh compilation show for tomorrow, a Best of Caller Questions podcast. So look for that to be posted on investtalk.com and other platforms. And remember, the InvestTalk downloads are free. And now, my phone lines are open, so give us a call. But before we hear from you, hopefully live, we'll answer this caller question that came in earlier from the United Kingdom.
Hi, Luke and Justin. It's Alex here from the UK. I'm calling about a couple of insurers. I currently have a position in Aon, A-O-N ticker, which is a big 62 billion market cap insurer. And I'm just trying to consider my options as it's not doing so great at the moment, has pulled back quite a lot on the back of earnings. Everything does look good with it. The PE is kind of average 22, which is sort of the lower end of where it has been. Cash flow is increasing. They are buying back shares, and I think they only have about 10 billion debt. And I'm just wondering whether it would be a good idea, but to look at a slightly smaller name. In particular, I was looking at RLI, which again is a smaller 6 billion market cap. Even the PE looks similar, around 20. The price has increased quite nicely on RLI. However, it still seems to be reasonably valued. And I was just wondering if you thought potentially moving from the bigger name into a slightly smaller and potentially more upside name in RLI is a good idea. I'm in my mid-30s, so risk is not too much of an issue there. And I was looking at RLI being a sort of 135 a share buy point. We'd love to hear your thoughts about both of those companies and whether transitioning over from one to the other would be a good idea. Thanks a lot. Bye.
So both RLI and AON, I think AON, Aon might have been part of Market Madness, but both of these companies are insurers. And so the caller mentioned that earnings were fine, but the price seems to be pulling back. And that's because in December of last year, they announced that they were going to dish out $7 billion in cash to buy NFP. The market didn't like that. Why didn't the market like that? Because at the same time, cash flow is falling. So in order to justify that, cash flow would have to really take a turn, and they would have to be more profitable than they have been recently. So let's take a look at RLI. Well, RLI is trading at a price to book of about 4.36, which is reasonable given their growth. They actually had above average industry growth. They are certainly a smaller company, $6 billion market cap versus the $62 billion that Aon is. But we do know that those small caps and mid caps tend to, in the long term, provide higher expected returns than those large caps do, because you are taking on excess levels of risk. Their debt, it's not bad. They got about $115 million in debt on that $6.6 billion market cap company. So not much to worry about there. It looks like they consistently issue shares, but they've only issued about 1 million shares in the past 5 years. So nothing crazy there. And their earnings are improving. Their earnings forecasts are set to improve over the next couple years, but their margins are actually shrinking. So this year, their net margin was 21%. Next year, it's supposed to shrink to 15.8%. But for a lot of the insurance industry, that's actually something that is not too dissimilar. And that's because, well, there's been a lot of payouts recently. And so honestly, overall, given Aon's, in my opinion, poor business decision in December to dish out a bunch of cash when their cash flow is falling, I think it is a fine time to move on. They've drawn down a little bit. I think that 135 is actually a pretty decent price for RLI. It's trading at 145 right now, given it's at that 4.36 times price to book. Probably wait for that to come down to 3.5 before you buy in. But certainly, I think that's a good trade-off to make. Like I said, generally speaking, in the long run, you tend to have higher expected returns from investing in those small and mid-cap businesses. And this one certainly looks like it's in a good position going forward with its growth. So thanks for the call. Now let's shift gears back to an important story about really the tumultuous start to 2024, which was characterized by high inflation and economic uncertainty, and how recent data is starting to moderate, both in inflation, consumer spending, and economic activity, and how that has put back on the forefront the idea that we may be headed towards a soft landing. So let's dive in a little bit. So first off, this past Wednesday, CPI came in for April, and it was slightly below expectations, which was certainly welcome, a welcome change. It suggested that inflation might be finally cooling off a little bit. Core CPI, which excludes volatile food and energy prices, rose at its slowest year-over-year pace since April of 2021, about a 3.6% increase. So this continued trend of disinflation, albeit slow, supports this new view, seems like there's a new view every week, that we might be inching back towards the Fed's 2% inflation target. However, on the same day, a report on April's retail sales indicated a slowdown in consumer spending, with sales remaining flat from March and growing only 2.7% from a year earlier. So this combination of easing inflation and slowing economic growth has revitalized the idea that there might be some cuts on the horizon. And so that benefited major indices, the Dow intraday moving past 40,000 for the first time, the S&P 500 and NASDAQ making new highs. And so investors seem to interpret these trends as potential triggers for a change in Federal Reserve policy, particularly regarding interest rates. Interestingly enough, futures market reacted pretty swiftly on Wednesday. By midday, by the afternoon, the probability of the Fed cutting rates by its September meeting had jumped to over 75%. 75%. There's also speculative chatter that a potential rate cut could come as early as this summer. Why? Well, before the Fed's meeting this summer, there's actually two more months of data that will be released that, should they show some serious improvements in the disinflationary trend, could bolster the Fed's case to begin cuts, especially with if that consumer data continues to deteriorate. So what does that mean for the economy and the broader market, or rather for the broader economy? First, the current environment is reminiscent of that Goldilocks scenario where it's not too hot, it's not too cold, where slowing inflation and stable growth could ideally balance each other out. But as tends to be the case, the reality is a little bit more nuanced. The slowdown in consumer spending, despite not signaling a recession, is cautionary because there is a cumulative effect of higher prices and rising interest rates and increased debt levels on household budgets. Because of that, if the deflationary trend continues alongside this economic cooling, the pressure to cut rates could intensify. And so what that would end up doing is it might stimulate spending and it might stimulate investment. Well, what could happen then? Inflation could be reignited. So although we're not out of the woods yet, we are making good progress. But the problem with being in a not too hot, not too cold Goldilocks scenario is that a wrong move in either direction too soon or too much could throw us off balance. So we shouldn't forget, honestly, we need to take a step back sometimes and realize how remarkable it is that we are where we are, given where we were just a short year ago. But as I always say, any one data point is not enough. It's important to look at the trend. So over the next couple months, it'll be critical, as the Fed says, they're data dependent, to decide the path of interest rates moving forward. Let's go ahead and dip back into the question pool. This is a question that one of our viewers left for us on our Invest Talk YouTube channel. And that question is on BELFB. I wanted to ask you your thoughts on Belfuse. It's a small cap company, which I currently have an investment in. They had a large increase over the past 24 months, but mostly sideways the last 9 months or so. Profitability is increasing. Sales growth is single digits. Price to sales or book is much lower than competitors. I would appreciate your thoughts on BELFB and if you prefer it as a value versus other names. So let's pull up BELFB. So Belfuse designs, manufactures, and supplies electronic solutions for various industries, with its power solutions and protection segment being the main revenue contributor. Looks like it's a pretty strong business-to-business customer base. Its product diversity is pretty strong as well. And recent earnings caused a little bit of a correction. Past 3 months, they're down 10% year-to-date. They're down only 72 basis points. So in the past 3 months, there has been quite the correction. So the question becomes, is it at attractive levels now? Let's take a look at their debt levels. First and foremost, they only have about $75 million of debt, and that's on an $892 million market cap company. Their revenue growth, pretty stagnant. It's 3% year over year over the past 5 years, and it's really up and down. 2018, the revenue was 548, then 2019, it was 492, then 465, back up to 543. And next year, it's supposed to be $535 million after being $639 million last year. That's a pretty volatile revenue stream. And so that's honestly the first red flag right there when taking a look at this name. Let's look at its relative valuation. It looks like on a price to earnings, it's trading at 14%. Price to book is 2.4. Well, that makes sense given that there's been some pretty stagnant growth over the past 5 years. That being said, on a five-year annualized basis, it's actually beating the industry by 27.6%. Its cash flow from 2022 until now has been improving pretty rapidly, to be honest, as has its profitability. Its net margin is 11% this year, up from 8.1% next year. Supposed to settle back down to 10.5% next year. They don't have much short interest out. They pay a 42 basis point dividend, and their earnings were downgraded after last quarter. Honestly, taking a look at this business, I like the trajectory of its cash flow. I like the trajectory of its margins. I don't think it's overvalued that much, but for Aureli, really at all overvalued. But for me, the problem is that growth there, that sales growth. And so that's a lot of volatility there, especially within the small cap. And within the small cap space, I think there might be some excess risk you may be taking on for something that is pretty unstable. I think there are probably better names out there. Thanks for watching and thanks for the comment. Now we have a live call, live question that came in from Bill in Northern California on INTC. Do you own it? Or are you looking to buy it?
Hi, Luke. Yeah, I'm looking to buy it. I mean, you know, it's a good company overall. They have these issues going on. And, you know, I've had the experience in the past, you know, really strong companies like this, and they're having pullbacks because of a valid reason. But, you know, it could be seen as temporary in the sense that if you waited a year or 18 months from now, until, you know, all their prospects are looking better, the prices, stock's already priced up, and you have to get them when they're down, you know, and then be patient. Otherwise, you miss the first upswing in the stock. You maybe missed, you know, half or a third of the upswing. So you miss a big percentage. You know, I wish I'd bought it last year when it was $24. But how do you see it now within that context?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent position at this time. Yeah, that's an excellent point. You know, I've already said it once here is that it's not just about buying good businesses, it's about buying them at good prices. And so, you know, when some of these things tend to pull back, as Intel has been pulling back over the past really year and a half for the most part, it can provide a good buying opportunity. But in this situation, I think you need to see some turnaround from the business. Their cash flow kind of flatlined a little bit. Their profitability has fallen. And they have fallen behind one of their biggest competitors. And some of the investments they've made within the semi space really hasn't borne a lot of fruit. And so you're seeing that within their chart as well. And so it looks to me like, although it looks like it reached some support at 30, it may just cross that and go back down again. So this seems to be like a falling knife situation, especially over the past 5 months. This is a clear downward trend. I think over the long term, Intel has the capital and the strength and the ability of the within their supply chain to make a move within the semi space that they haven't been able to, especially with the domination within AI for NVIDIA and companies that supply NVIDIA. But I just think now is not the good time to buy them. So I would keep it on my watch list. To your point, you wish you'd bought it at 24, maybe don't put in your full allocation, dollar cost average over a longer period of time. But from a fundamental perspective, these are some bad trends, to be honest. So I would still wait a little bit. I don't think this company is going to go bankrupt, but just because a company is not going to go bankrupt doesn't mean it's the right time to buy it.
Very good. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. See if we can fit another one in.
Hi, Justin and Luke. I was calling to get your opinion on an insurance company called Chubb. The symbol is CB. So wanted to see what you thought of the industry and what would be a good entry point. Thank you, and I'll be listening for the answer on your podcast.
Question is about Chubb, ticker CB, and Chubb is a commercial and personal property and casualty insurance company. They cover personal accidents, healthcare, stuff like that. And so the reason why Chubb is in the news recently is because Warren Buffett announced that he has a stake in it. And so naturally, people are going to start talking about it. So let's take a look at its fundamentals. It's got about $18 billion on debt. On a $102 billion market cap company. It made $21.80 a share last year. It's supposed to make $21.67 this year and at $23.68 next year. Its cash flow, improving. Its profitability looks pretty good. Its relative strength, better than some other insurance names. It's up 17% year to date. It's up 32% over the past year. And its price to book is only 1.7. Its average over the past year is 1.4, but it's price to earnings, 11.3. Honestly, I'm not seeing a lot that I don't like. It's up 4.7%, probably for the reason that I mentioned. It's been in the news. So certainly there's a lot of activity that may be devoid from the fundamental analysis of this company right now. But even at that inflated value, it still seems fairly priced to me. So I might wait until some of this market activity subsides. But overall, this looks like a pretty solid company. Thanks for the call. This is Invest Talk, and I'm Luke Guerrero, and we have one goal here, and that is to help you achieve your financial freedom. Now, our work continues after this break, and it's our last break, so get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Luke Guerrero is here and ready to tackle your questions.
I wanted to pick your brain about Apple. What did you think about their earnings call? Is this a good time to add to my position?
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART. Luke Guerrero is here and ready to take on your finance and investment questions. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Justin and Luke. This is Veer from Atlanta, Georgia. My question is in regards to Vital Farms, ticker symbol V as in Victor, I as in Iceland, T as in Tango, L as in London, V-I-T-L. Have been tracking this particular stock from the last 6 months. They make products like dairy products, eggs, love their products. So was just wondering what would be a good price for this stock to add to my portfolio. It was in December, it was somewhere around $15, which was at a higher PE ratio back then. But I can see that stock moving up to 35, 36 now. And was wondering if you see this stock coming down, when I can start picking it up. Thank you.
So Vital Farms operates within two segments. One is their egg segment, another is their butter and dairy products. And their egg segment makes up about 95% of their revenue. I like this company as a seller of eggs because my girlfriend likes this company. And if you like something your girlfriend likes, then typically your life is happier. But taking a look at the fundamentals of this company, their cash flow, certainly improving over the past year. Profitability is improving over the past year. And the reason why this company is up 141% year to date and 164% over the past year is right here. And if you're not watching this on YouTube, I'll tell you, their last quarter's earnings, 100% surprise. 0.43 EPS versus 0.21, which is the estimate. So because of that, they had a massive, massive run-up. Now the question was, do I think it's coming down? From a fundamental perspective, it should come down, but we talked earlier about rationality and sensibility. Now, I think a better price for this company to get in on, given that its PDE ratio is about 38 right now for a company that makes eggs, is probably closer to 25. And I think that given the recent run-up, it's probably going to get hit some resistance soon and try and find some new support. So I would wait until then. If it doesn't get there, it doesn't get there. But again, it's about more than getting good businesses. It's about getting businesses at good prices. So I like this company. I like their products, but not at a forward-looking PDE of 38. That is incredibly expensive. Thanks for the call. Now, before we head off for the weekend in terms of live shows, because again, tomorrow we have a best of episode, I wanted to touch on an important case that came out of the Supreme Court, and that is a ruling that upheld the mechanism by which the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is funded. And so with a 7-2 vote, the court rejected a challenge that contended that their funding violated the Appropriations Clause of the Constitution, a clause which stipulates essentially that no money can be drawn from the Treasury except by appropriations made by law. And so the challenge argued that this funding mechanism, where the agency receives money directly from the Federal Reserve System, was unconstitutional. Now, the ruling is pivotal for a couple reasons. First, it preserves the operational integrity of the CFPB, which, if you don't recall, is an agency that was created in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis as part of the Dodd-Frank Act. And because the Bureau has been responsible since 2008 for regulating mortgages, credit cards, consumer loans, banking, all sorts of financial products, and making sure that there isn't the predatory lending that caused much of the 2008 financial collapse. And so a ruling against the CFPB could have been really bad. Why? Because it could have cast doubt on every regulation and enforcement action it's taken in the past almost 20 years. The decision also touches on broader themes related to the structure and funding of independent agencies within the federal government. Think about the Fed. The Fed is independent because entities like the Fed operate with a degree of financial autonomy to enhance its independence, meaning that as political parties take office, as different ebbs and flows happen within our political system, important institutions like the Fed and the CFPB can remain independent. For policymakers and stakeholders in the financial sector, the ruling reaffirms the stability and continuity of the regulatory and enhancement framework and further protecting the broader public. Overall, I would say it ensures that the Bureau can continue its work in protecting consumers from unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices without the immediate threat of being financially crippled by politicians that may disagree with it. Now, I'm Luke Guerrero, and this completes another episode of Invest Talk. We thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads. Get yours anytime at iTunes, Google Play, or Spotify, and please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. And if you leave us a question, we'll try and get to that. We'd like to get to those as fast as we possibly can. I hope you've heard that the Invest Talk podcast is also available in video form on our YouTube channel. Search Invest Talk, and don't forget, that's Invest Talk with two T's. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Enjoy your weekend.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.